supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the mental well-being of our children. This week marks National Children's Mental Health Awareness Day. You know, typically when we think about mental health, we're really thinking about mental illness, but that perspective can really limit our understanding of how children's minds develop and what they need to thrive. Let's kick things off with an interview I did with Pamela Hyde. She engages with these issues regularly in her role as the administrator of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA, in Washington, D.C. It's under Health and Human Services. I asked her how she and her department promote mental well-being early in a child's development.
Well, that's a very good question, and that's exactly why we're trying to do the work that we are. We understand that a lot of the adult mental health issues, both substance abuse and mental illness in our society, start in very young childhood. So about 50% of the adult issues start before age 14, and about three-quarters of them start before age 25. So we understand that the need for prevention and emotional health development is very critical.
What do we know about prevention? What works? What doesn't work?
Well, we know a lot, actually. We know a lot about risk and protective factors. We know a lot about building resilience in young people. We know a lot about the fact that almost every young person is going to experience childhood adversity, some a whole lot and some just a little, but all of those adverse events can have negative impacts on their emotional health and then ultimately their mental health. But we also know that those can be opportunities to build resilience, help them understand how to handle those issues, how to manage emotions, and how to make good decisions for themselves. We also know, actually, the Institute on Medicine released a report in 2009 that was all about preventing emotional and behavioral disorders among young people.
Can you give us a summary of what they said?
Well, they basically said that, interestingly enough, we need to start a lot sooner. Kids or young people exhibit symptoms somewhere between 4 and 6 years before they typically get into treatment. So there are signs and symptoms that we wait too long for. So one thing is to get in and deal with the issues earlier. They are very clear that determining what risk factors are, and there are social risk factors, there are personal risk factors, there are psychological risk factors.
Let me stop you there. So tick off a couple, personal, social, and psychological risk factors. What do we have to keep our eye on, both as clinicians, as parents?
Well, social risk factors might be what's going on in the social environment that they live in. So where they live, how they live, whether they're experiencing violence in their community, things of that nature. Personal risk factors might be things like whether they're in poverty or whether they are witnessing domestic violence in the home or live with an alcoholic or any number of other things that a young child might personally be exposed to. And psychological risk factors could be just the propensity because of either family issues or other kinds of even biological issues that might make them more at risk for psychological issues. So we do know that addiction and mental illness often have some physiological propensities as well. So when you put all those things together, what you want to do in a prevention program is address all of those issues and do it earlier rather than later.
What does that word mean, address?
There are a variety of programs, but just generically, one of the things we want to do is make sure that all the places that are touching those young people, whether it's their church, their school, their community, their after-school programs, their doctors, their all of the people who, their parents, all of the their teachers, all of them who touch that young person, have some information about how to deal with these issues and how to help young people develop emotional health very early. We want the same messages coming consistently from all those multiple sectors, and we want each of those sectors to have the skills to help that young person be emotionally healthy and resilient.
You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and we're talking with Pamela Hyde, the administrator of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We did a show about a study that more and more people are familiar with, and that's the what's called the ACEs study. That's
yes.
The Adverse Childhood Experience.
Right.
And what happens to these kids who are exposed to sustained stressors. But one of my guests was psychiatrist Sandy Bloom. She's here at Drexel, and, you know, she's a local psychiatrist, and she talks about trauma-informed everything. Trauma-informed therapist, but trauma-informed teachers and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's what you're talking about to a certain extent, Pam, yes?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, it's only been in the last decade or so that people have been talking about trauma-informed care. But we're actually now trying to go back upstream, and Dr. Bloom is one of the best advocates for this in talking about trauma-informed prevention. So understanding that adverse childhood events do have an impact on young children, especially if it is chronic stress that young people experience consistently, especially in the earlier ages, can have an impact on social and health development, including development of the brain. Literally, the size of the brain is different. The way the brain functions is different when they're exposed to that kind of chronic stress. So,
yeah, these poor young bodies can't tolerate all that cortisol.
We're learning more and more about how brains develop and about how decision-making and critical thinking and other kinds of skills that we sort of take for granted develop in young children, and when they're exposed to that kind of stress, it does have an impact.
All right, so I want to try to build a bridge between the administrator in Washington and the lowly clinician here in Philadelphia. So what does trauma-informed care, trauma-informed parenting, what does that look like?
Well, first of all, I think people are putting this into simpler terms by saying we want to ask more about what's happened to the child rather than what's wrong with the child. So when something is happening that brings a child into a treatment or brings them into a knowledge of a teacher or others that they're having issues, we want to immediately understand what's going on in that child's life, in that child's home, in that child's community that might be having an impact on that behavior. Sometimes the behavior is an attempt to communicate with us, maybe not even knowledgeably, but certainly the child's behavior can be telling us that something's going on. So rather than trying to take simply a behavioral approach or simply a medication approach, trying to look a little bit more at the child's environment and the child's situation and understanding what might be affecting them.
You know, one of the things I've been thinking about a great deal and going to begin to try to implement is mobilizing a network for these families. When a child's suffering in a high-stress family, then the family's suffering too, and they need help also.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think more and more both treatment as well as prevention is recognizing that it can't just be focused on the individual. It really does have to be focused on their family, their school, their community, the place in which they find themselves, in the environment in which they find themselves. And so that's part of the reason that the what we call multi-sectoral approach is important, that all of those aspects of a child's life is informed and capable of being supportive in that environment.
I threatened you before we went on the air, Pam, that I was going to ask you about your dreams.
Well, you know, we've been talking a whole lot here about our vision, and our vision is one in which we really do envision a nation that understands that behavioral health is really essential to health, that you really can't have health without behavioral health, and a nation that knows and acts on the knowledge that prevention works, that treatment is effective, and that people recover. I really would like to see what I think a lot of us want to see. I want to see a situation in which it's not forbidden to talk about or be concerned about mental health. I want a world that understands that we've got to be viewing this as a health issue. I want a world that recognizes that, frankly, we do need some help with helping parents be the best parents and teachers be the best teachers. We don't train people as much as we should about supporting that. I sometimes say that children are our future. We talk about that a lot, but they can either be our future leaders and our future parents and our future astronauts and our future good things, or they can be our future homeless people and our future inmates and our future abusers. So it's that kind of choice is ours.
And yeah, we all have a role to play in that. Pamela,
absolutely.
Pamela, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It's wonderful hearing someone with your authority and your position talk about these issues in such a heartfelt and sincere way.
Well, I appreciate it, Dan. I appreciate your interest. Thank you so much.
That was Pamela Hyde. She's the administrator of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration in Washington. Well, we're talking about children's mental health today on Voices in the Family, and we're going to be speaking with a variety of people looking at this from a variety of angles. We'll start with Dr. Anthony Biglin. He's the senior scientist at Oregon Research Institute, director of the Center on Early Adolescence, and he's the co-director of the Promise Neighborhood Research Consortium, and he joins us by phone from Oregon. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
We're going to be taking your calls in just a few minutes. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd like to hear from you about what it takes to really nurture a child's mind, promote mental health, and cut down on the risk for mental illness. Tony, were you able to hear the interview with Pam Hyde?
I was.
I have to tell you, it was shocking to me when she said her dream was that people would understand the connection between emotional mental health and physical health. I was shocked because that in the 21st century, it's still not a given?
Well, I share her concern. I've been concerned that, there's a fairly significant effort to try and improve health and health care. I still don't think it's adequately informed by the degree to which people's health problems, their cardiovascular disease and so on, is a function of the stressful environments they live in and the health behaviors that they develop, largely as a matter of living in those stressful environments.
Tony, Pam Hyde talked about people having the skills to help children develop healthier, become more resilient. So what skills are they actually? What do we need to know as parents and teachers?
Let me start with patients. One of the major findings in the last 30 years is we've realized that when parents are impatient, when they are irritable with kids, they're more likely to actually develop problems. If we can help parents to become more patient and to kind of join the kid in what they're doing and extend the child's understanding of the world and extend their skills, I think that's one of the pivotal things in terms of kid success. If you look, Pam mentioned the Institute of Medicine report on prevention, and I was one of the people on the committee that produced that report. We reviewed a whole bunch of parenting interventions for parents from preschool age through adolescence, and all of them involve helping parents to become more patient, more caring, to be more positively reinforcing about the kinds of things kids do, and to set limits on opportunities that kids might have to develop problems. And there's a whole host of these interventions that have been shown to be valuable for kids of all ages.
Well, you know, psychotherapy 101, you know, we're trained to wonder as we listen to our patients, clients, what's the message here? What are they trying to say? What are they trying to say with their behavior, their emotion, their dream? What are they trying to say? So I like what Pam Hyde said about trauma-informed care, trauma-informed even parenting. So when you see a child acting up or acting out, the question is not what's wrong with you, but what's happened to you? What are you really trying to say and don't have the words or the tools to say it?
Yeah, and you were talking about the fact that it's not just a matter of treating the individual, that it's a matter of their environment, and I think that's really true. What we need to do as a matter of public health is to try to get to the point where all families and all schools, especially families and schools, are nurturing places that are not coercive, they're not critical, not punishing, but are richly reinforcing and teaching the kind of pro-social behavior the kids need.
Well, I think you will be very happy after our break in about 5 minutes, because we're going to hear from Salome Thomas L., also known as Principal L. He heads a charter school in Wilmington, Delaware, and you're going to have a feeling you're going to hear some very gratifying things from him. She also said, Pam Hyde also said, that we know a lot about prevention and what works and what doesn't. So what does work?
Well, let me start with families. Just start with young children, because I think it's probably the place to really get what kids need. There are a variety of interventions that have been provided to parents of young children, and all of them have to do with teaching the parent to join the child in the activities that the child is involved in. And in the context of joining the child about what the child's interested in, that's the context in which you can teach the child a little bit more and a little bit more, and you can develop their positive behavior. So being responsive and in sync with what is important to the child is a key skill.
Come back to what I said to Pam Hyde about my thoughts about involving the network, because often parents don't get involved with the child because they can't, because of their own psychological issues, because of their lack of skill, because of jobs they're working, mm-hmm. their exhaustion. There's a lot of factors. So
absolutely,
you know, it's my belief what I'm trying to do here, or going to do, is mobilize an entire network around this family. We're talking about community, extended family, social agencies, to really provide for this family what we would like, ideally, this family to do for the child.
Well, I think that's very important. You mentioned our Promise Neighborhood Research Consortium, and what we're doing there is we've been trying to help high-poverty neighborhoods to develop the kinds of practices that could really make a difference in terms of the successful development of kids in high-poverty neighborhoods. And I think you're right that we need to... I mean, poverty is a huge problem in this country. We have the highest rates of economic inequality of any developed country, and we have the highest rates of child poverty of any country. And these are huge risk factors. And as you suggest, parents who are working two jobs, who are stressed by poverty and so on, it's harder for them to do a good job. And so to the extent that we can provide family supports and improve the economic well-being of families, we're going to have a distinct benefit for the kids. But I also think it's important to recognize that even in the context of stressful situations, that we can help parents to develop skills that will actually make the family life less aversive to everyone in the family, and will both help the children and reduce the parents' stress. Because there's a kind of a reciprocity between parents and kids. If a child's acting up, it's a stressor for the parent, as well as when the parent isn't dealing with it well, it's a stressor for the child.
Hmm. We've got to take a short break, Tony. Stick with us. We're talking about children's mental health, and when we return, we're going to hear more from Tony Biglin of the Origin Research Institute, and hopefully We'll hear from you at 888-477-9499. But like I said earlier, we'll also hear from Salone Thomas L., also known as Principal L. He heads a charter school in Wilmington, Delaware. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about children's mental health, what we can do to foster our children's mental health and to help them deal with stressors in a healthy way so that they can thrive in life. My guests are Anthony Biglin. He's a senior scientist at the Argonne Research Institute and director of the Center on Early Adolescence. Joining us now is Salone Thomas L., also known as Principal L. He's the head of school at Thomas Edison Charter School in Wilmington, Delaware. His latest book is called The Immortality of Influence, and he's paired up with Dr. Oz to educate America about the importance of living healthy inside and out. Principal L, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, sir.
Tell us about the children you work with.
I'm working at I have a charter school, K through 8 in Wilmington, Delaware, about 735 students, 96% at or below poverty. Students from very tough areas, very tough backgrounds, but I'm so proud of you just for providing this show and information for your listeners, because the family is so important. I think when we talk about protective factors for young people, there's no greater protective factor than the family, you know, here in our nation. And I think that if we're going to build a better nation, we have to begin with building a better families. And that begins with providing important, groundbreaking information like you are. And I think that these children that I work with, they come from struggling families, many good families. But I think that when schools become places where, you know, like Dr. Hyde talked about and Mr. Biglin, when they talk about the school being a place where students are able to feel successful, where students are safe, students are protected, the majority of students spend the majority of their lives, you know, in schools or in the community. So and often, you know, in poor communities, we never, ever discuss mental health. So this show is so important.
Shameful.
In so many ways. Yes, sir. Very, very much so. I'm shameful because it is our children who suffer the most. And again, those children who suffer as young people become adults who suffer even more. So I am proud of these students. We offer a rigorous and challenging program for our students, pre-AP courses in middle school. For the most struggling students, need to have the most rigorous curriculum. Our students experience two words every day: rigor and joy. Very important in lives of struggling students.
I want to get to some of those details, but I want to follow up here with you, Tony. We talked about trauma-informed environments, trauma-informed parenting. So how can we create a trauma-informed environment to make them safe and accepting?
Well, you know, I have to confess that the concept trauma-informed is somewhat new to me, and I gathered from your interview with Pam that you are up on it. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the heart of it is when we see a child acting out, then the question is, what happened to you? Now, what's wrong with you? We don't first look at a child's brain or psychology. You know, we look at the environment around them. You know, vast majority of the children the vast majority of children live through adversity.
And so it's a matter of increasing people's sensitivity to the things that might be the origins of kids' behavior problems.
Yeah, and we can guarantee that there is an origin, and then it becomes our responsibility. If we can't understand what the origin is, then that's our problem, not the child's problem. And before we jump in and try to fix a child, we have to care for them. And that's a trauma-informed environment.
Well, you know, one of the things that comes to mind as we talk about this is that it's very difficult very often for people to be in contact with the unpleasant experiences of other people. So if you tell me about a traumatic event that happened to you, I may not want to hear about it just because it's distressing to me. And so one of the things that's been developing in psychological interventions is the sort of mindfulness and acceptance-based interventions that help people to become willing to have whatever thoughts and feelings they have. And I think that that approach, which is encouraging a kind of self-compassion with people where they kind of accept whatever thoughts and feelings they have, is a basic grounding foundation for people to be compassionate toward other people. So I think that's probably one of the things that we need to consider when we are talking about encouraging people to be open to the difficulties that other people are having and to the things that they themselves may have done that contributed to the other person having a problem.
Yeah, so we're talking about kindness and compassion.
Just indeed.
Right up front. Principal L, what do you do to make that school setting, first of all, physically safe, and then emotionally safe?
Well, I think that what I try to do, and what I try to encourage other administrators and teachers to do, is to keep in mind that students must all learn self-efficacy. You know, and even as adults, as educators, see the issue is the adults who are working with the children are living under stressful conditions. They have their own stresses in their lives. They need to build their own resilience. And so within the confines of a school building, you want to make sure that students, when they walk in the building, they feel that they matter, that they have meaningful participation in school. We only have 7 million minutes. From the time a child is in pre-K to graduation from high school.
So how do you do that when they walk in the building?
When they walk in the building, you address those students by name. You make sure that those students know that there is at least one adult in that building who cares for them at all times. You know, my motto is that every child deserves to have at least one person be crazy about them.
How do you do that?
You go about making sure that you hire people on your team who have a history. I love hiring former social workers and Peace Corps volunteers as teachers, because these are people who have lived a life of service. You know, leadership is about service. If you don't serve, you can't lead. And so you need folks who have been in the trenches, and they need to understand that building relationships with young people are very, very, very important. Those protective factors that they need when they're growing up in this rough world that we live in is that one of the most important factors, that there have to be adults at home, in the community, and in school who care about them. So you build a great team. Teamwork makes the dream work. So when you're working with challenging students, you have to make sure those students are surrounded everywhere they go with people who care, who have high expectations, but who care enough to help those students meet those expectations.
Speaking of healthy environments and safe environments, what do you feed your kids?
I have not. I'll tell you what I don't. I have not served one nugget or one French fry all school year. I have a company I work with, Revolution Foods, who provides all organic, all natural, healthy food to my children for breakfast and lunch every day. Now, my students complain because it's not Big Macs and Happy Meals and all the other things. But it's such a change of pace for our young people. So, you know, these students are learning about eating low salt, you know, low fat, you know, low sugar. These are all things that many adults have struggled with. So we have to start early. So we are proud to say that we don't serve any pink slime, and we haven't spent a dime on nuggets or French fries, you know, for our students. So
some kids would consider that an abusive environment.
Yes, they do. You would be surprised and shocked at how many students request to have meetings with me about this lunch, this unhealthy lunch that you're serving us, you know, Principal L. But I'm proud of those young people because they have come around and they know. And my parents as well, because the parents have to deal with the children coming home and saying, you know, we're not getting macaroni and cheese and we're not getting, you know, fish patties and chicken patties and everything frozen and fried, because everything comes in unfrozen.
What's the name of the company?
It's Revolution Foods, and it's a program that's supported by Michelle Obama, and the company is growing around the nation. It started in California, but it's just wonderful for our young people to be able to get, because we know what all of your experts are saying is that healthy mind, healthy body, and they go hand in hand.
Well, as a non-commercial station, we can't promote. We can only inform. So Revolution Foods is kind of...
Can I throw in one other consideration on diet?
Yes,
yeah,
sir.
Please.
Omega-3. I'd ask all your listeners to look at any processed food they have, and they will see that very frequently one of the things in those processed foods is soybean oil, soy oil. And that's high in omega-6. And omega-6 has been shown to increase aggression, depression, and obesity. And the American diet has become much more heavily using omega-6 than was ever the case in human history. And there are good studies showing that omega-3 supplementation, which you get omega-3, the best way to get it out is out of fish, but there are also supplements. And there are good studies showing the benefits of that for weight loss and for cognitive development and for reducing aggression.
Tony, tell us about the Promise Neighborhood Research Consortium. Does that work, and how do we know it works?
Well, I can't say for sure that it works, but I will tell you that, you know, the Promise Neighborhood Initiative was started by President Obama, and it was inspired by the Harlem Children's Zone, where they're trying to implement programs from the prenatal period through early adulthood to help make sure that every child goes, you know, cradle to career is successful. And they're now doing that in 98 square blocks in Harlem and getting some good results. And so the Department of Education has been funding Promise Neighborhoods around the country to do, to try to implement the same kinds of interventions. We created the Promise Neighborhood Research Consortium to provide scientific support. And if you go to our website, which is promiseneighborhoods.org, you'll find that we've detailed the kinds of skills and abilities that a child needs at every stage of development, the kinds of influences from families and schools and peers that have an impact on kids' development, and the larger context that affects that, including poverty and chaos in the neighborhoods and so on. And if you go to our What Works section of the website, you'll find programs and policies and what we call kernels, simple behavioral influence practices. Principal L mentioned that they greet every kid when he comes to school. That's actually a practice that has been shown in research to calm kids and to make them feel more comfortable at school.
And a little thing like that. Tony, we've got to take a short break, and I know we're going to be saying goodbye to you. So I want to thank you so much for your time, and thanks for the work you do.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Tony Biglin is with the Oregon Research Institute. Like I said, we're going to take a short break. This week marks National Children's Mental Health Awareness Day. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Principal L. of the Thomas Edison Charter School in Delaware. And we'll also hear from Becky Espanol of the Parents Involved Network in Philadelphia. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 170. 215-222-3200, extension 170.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about children's mental health, how to promote it, nurture it, and what we can do to prevent problems down the pike with these children. You've been hearing from Salome Thomas L. He's head of school at Thomas Edison Charter School in Wilmington. And I'm joined now by Becky Espanol. She's an advocate for the Parents Involved Network of Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia branch. Becky, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, how are you?
So tell us about the Parents Involved Network. What's the main mission here?
The main mission of Parents Involved Network is that we are parents, we're peers of children. We all have children with a different challenge, with a different special need, and we're here to support families, to help them understand how to navigate the system, what their rights are, the rights of their children, how to access the supports and services that their children need to be successful.
Are there enough supports?
There are enough supports. It's just for each child is different. It's a different level. It's a different support. It's at different times. It's a matter of understanding the system, accessing the system, knowing especially how to navigate the system, and especially knowing exactly what your rights are under that system.
So give us a scenario. I'd like to get a sense of who you work with, you know, the parents you work with. And I would think, you know, if you look at them as, you know, the bigger picture, that they certainly need services for their child, but they probably need even more than that.
Yeah, going back to your first question just for a second, when you were asking if there was enough services, I think that the rights of the children are there and the parents. It's just that because of the economy and everything that is happening now, you know, the services are starting to diminish. And by parents accessing our supports as Parents Involved Networks, we work with children with emotional and behavior health and any other parent that needs our supports also, but mostly mainly children with emotional and behavior health. When they access our supports, we help them by first understanding what are the needs of the child, seeing exactly where are they at the moment when they call us, and from there we try to support families of understanding how can they themselves be their best assertive and advocate for their own child by supporting them and helping them understand how to access those supports and services. And we also do one-to-one advocacy. So we'll go with them to the meetings to make sure that...
Yeah, you know, as I'm listening to you, when you talk about one-on-one advocacy, I'm thinking of what Principal L said a few minutes ago about everyone needs someone to be crazy about them. And not just crazy about these parents, but these parents need to have someone who gets it, who can be with them during the difficult time. That's critical.
It is very critical, and it is especially, thank you for saying that, because we are peers, a lot of the parents when they call us, you know, some of them are frustrated, some of them are already crying because they don't understand what else can they do for their children. They think that there's no more doors to open. And once they start telling us their stories and we start saying, yes, we understand you, and they're like, I don't think so. We're like, yes, we're peers. We also have children that went through the system, and we're here giving back what we learned. And they're like, oh, so you understand me. And that opens up the doors. They connect to us. They know that we understand them. They have that special fusion with us because now they know that we've been through it and we're there to support them also.
Yeah, it's like when I do an evaluation with somebody who's a new quadriplegic like me, and I don't have to say anything. I mean, they look at me, and then they have hope, you know, that they can be happy. They can have a life. And that's what happens when they connect with you. And I would imagine the same thing with you, Principal L. You've got your own history. You've got your own background that's not unlike these children.
Yes, sir. No, I grew up in the Diamond Street Project right in North Philadelphia near Temple University, single-parent home, single mom, raised many children, but taught me that education would be, you know, my salvation. And just as a resource to your listeners, you know, on Friday and Saturday, the DeVacy Conference will be in town. It's the Delaware Valley Association for the Education of Young Children. Over 2,500 parents, educators, caregivers of early childhood, elementary age children will be in this city learning about how to talk to children, how to find out, you know, if they're having emotional issues, if they're parents who need support. I'll be speaking at the conference on Friday morning, and it's a great resource. There'll be workshops. It'll be at the Convention Center, the Pennsylvania Convention Center, and this is an awesome organization, part of a national association, but they provide so many resources and support for educators and parents and caregivers for early childhood. And I just think that if anyone's out there looking for solutions, Dan, we've been admiring the problem for a long time.
Yeah.
It's time for us to find solutions and get into action. This opportunity right at this conference.
Let me pin you down here with concrete. You talked about the conference teaching parents how to talk to children. So? How do we talk to children?
Very important. Number one, as a parent myself, the parent of two girls, so I don't get much ESPN in my house, is we often have to, you know, have those conversations with our children. How are you feeling? How are you doing? What's going on in school? Who are your friends? We need to make sure we're meeting their friends, meeting the teachers, but talking to our children about, you know, not just assuming that because they look well, that they're well emotionally. We really need to find out, you know, what our children are eating, you know, how they're living, what adults are involved in their lives, giving our children freedom to be honest with us. But we have to have those conversations early. 3, 4, 5 years old is not too early. We've got to get the prevention is much more effective than intervention.
Let me add something else. The only way children are going to feel free to open up to parents is when they do not feel judged or lectured at. So compassionate parenting involves, you know, putting your own reactive emotions in check for the moment and just listening and not saying anything.
Listening to understand is what one of the values that we teach our students, and I'm teaching my staff as well. Not listening to respond, but listening to understand. Very few people have mastered that skill, and it's something you're correct that in terms of talking to our children, it's a great skill for parents and teachers.
Becky, I know that a lot, you know, we're talking about all these wonderful programs and all this, you know, wonderful schools like Principal L has, but a lot of children fall through the cracks.
Yes, they do.
Awful lot. So who's more likely to fall through the cracks? What's going to happen to them?
If I piggyback on what the principal just said, I think that people need to feel validated, and that should be children and adults. And if you want children and parents to feel that they can trust and that they can work with, like if we're talking about the educational part, they need to feel validated. They need to feel that they are partners, that they need to feel that we are all here for the same purpose, to support our children and our families. They need to feel that if they come and they speak to anyone at the educational arena, they are peers. They're not there to be looked down to. They're not there to be talked down to any time, any moment. They need to feel that we're partners. We're here, all here to learn. We're all here for the same purpose, to support our families and our children, to have progress, to have a healthy community, to have a healthy school. It's all a matter of validating.
You know, when any of us face great adversity, one of the earliest reactions is we feel alone in the world, as though no one else has experienced it, or certainly no one has experienced it like we do. And it's that isolation that is probably the most stressful and most destructive of all of it. How do, you know, you talk about the people you work with, Becky, but you're talking, I assume, about people who reach out to you.
Yes.
What about those who don't? What happens to them?
It's even hard to think about that because I just think about the ones that do reach to us and how they feel when they call us thinking that they're alone and that there's nobody else who understands them. I can just think about the parents that don't know about other people who can be their peers, who can be their mentors, who can be their coach, who can be their supporter. I imagine they must feel very lonely and very isolated. Maybe they think that what they're going through, nobody else has.
How do they reach out to you?
All they have to do is call us. We have an information line that is 267-507-3860.
So wait. Do that again.
That will get to Parents Involved Network.
Yeah. What's the phone number?
267-507-3860.
Okay. Any other way?
Yes, they do get referred by other agencies. We do, as Parents Involved Network, we go to other agencies in the mental health education and we give information about ourselves. We go to conferences, we go to fairs, we go out to the community, we go to schools when we provide our information so they all know about us and how can we support the families that they are supporting and serving.
I want to come back to Thomas Edison Charter School for a minute. One of the ways you build resilience in your children is teaching them all chess and how to respond when they're not successful. Why chess, other than the fact that I'm guessing it's your passion?
It's a passion of mine, but a greater passion is critical thinking and problem solving. And this is something that I've been doing for years, Dan. And I was at the Vaux Middle School from 1987 until 1999, and then moved on to John F. Reynolds Elementary School. And every student who was ever in my presence had to learn to play chess at Vaux. Our students there were 8-time national chess champions, 7 consecutive national titles, never done before, you know, in America. These are inner city students. Chess teaches students to critically think, problem solve, to think 2-3 moves ahead. But, you know, it's also a great opportunity to sit across from a child and have a conversation. How are you doing? Chess is intergenerational. It is, these, you can, an 80-year-old can sit across from an 8-year-old and be very challenged by that 8-year-old, but it gives you a chance to sit there and talk to that student. They learn patience. So it is an awesome, awesome game and challenge for our students.
Do you know, Principal Elder, I read a piece of research, I think last year, that showed that our children coming out of high school, out of college, have more knowledge than previous generation, but have less problem-solving skills, are less skilled at critical thinking, and have more difficulty on the job that require those things.
Oh, so, no doubt. That's why the students at Thomas Edison Charter, we just returned from San Diego at the National Junior High Chess Championship, and my students finished runner-ups for the national title, and it's only their second year at the Nationals. I had a young man who was national champion in his section, a young lady who was third place. It's great for young ladies because of this day and age, young ladies have to be thinking at all times. And so it's an awesome opportunity to be able to teach our students to think and to learn. Self-efficacy is not about teaching students to be successful. It's about teaching them how to respond when they're not. We fear failure and we can't. We must embrace
For
it.
For example, how to respond to failure.
When you don't do well on a test, our students have to have that growth mindset. They can't have the fixed mindset where if I don't do well, I'm not intelligent. No, intelligence is not something you own. Smart is not something you are. It's something you can become. And children must learn that. But from the adults around them who teach them that if you don't do well, you'll fail and you'll never be good. Or mommy and daddy weren't good at that, so you won't be good at math. No, we must teach our students that success only comes before work in the dictionary. You are successful because you work hard, and I can guarantee you, you will fail. But failure is motivating. Success can be paralyzing. So we teach those students, if you can look up, you can get up. You embrace failure, you own it, you learn from it, and you grow from it. Those students who are successful, students who said they learned early in life at an early age that hard work will be the only way for them to be able to reach their destiny and reach their goals. And I think that we have to teach children at an early age that it will be their hard work and their success, teaching them to be resilient, teaching them to be persistent. Persistence overcomes resistance. In the communities where our children live, in high poverty communities, they must learn to overcome obstacles early. Many of these students are raising themselves, raising younger siblings. So a show like this will go, you don't understand or believe the influence that this show will have in communities far beyond our local community, because people are hearing about a subject we rarely ever talk about, the emotional well-being of young people and adults. As Ms. Espanol talked about, that adults as well need companions. They need advocates. They, as you said, every adult needs someone to be crazy about them as well. And so I'm proud that we're here today and that, you know, your listeners are listening and understanding that we can make a difference, that every child deserves to have some people, have someone be crazy about them. And it starts right now.
The only problem is, as I listen to you, is to be honest, between you and me, I'm hearing a lack of energy, a lack of passion over there.
I'm not giving you enough energy.
Oh my God. I'm sitting here listening to you. I'm thinking, I want some of that stuff. I'm getting a pint of his blood, whether he knows it or not.
It's just working with young people really inspires you. And also working with people like your guests here today on your show, and people like you who are advocates for children and for families. Families matter. That's the theme for the DeVacy Conference. Family matters, and it's so important that we must build our families.
So before we have to close our show, I want to remind our listeners about the DeVacy Conference at the Convention Center this weekend, and I want to remind them, Becky, about the Parents Involved Network. You can look it up online, or you can call.
You can call 267-507-3860 or go online under the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania.org.
That's great. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's such an important topic. My guests have been Anthony Biglin, Salome Thomas L., and Becky Espanol. Early in the show, we heard from Pamela Hyde of the Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration. Next week, we're going to be talking about parenting after the death of a child. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and our production team is at voices@whyy.org. And you can download today's show or listen to past shows at whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content here at WHYY. Emily Haas is our volunteer. This week, we say goodbye and thank you to Mark Cernero, our intern. Good luck to you, my friend. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer par excellence. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.